Hello and welcome to White Noise Weekly on the White Noise Podcast, episode 7. Guys, we've done it. We hit our milestone. We hit 7.
7 counts as a milestone nowadays? I thought it was like 10.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
That means
yeah.
we're past the first season half mark.
Yeah, you know, new TV shows like on HBO sometimes, the ones that they're not sure it's going to work out, like, you know, Parks and Recreation is a good example. There's 6 episodes.
Or if you're, you know, anything to do with Vince Gilligan, you basically get an extension after the first premiere episode to 2 seasons.
I really kind of wonder, like, what his original idea for season one, like, how far into season, like, beginning of season 2, how much of that was part of season one before the writer's strike happened?
Who knows, man?
It's the interesting questions of life. Well, I'm Billy White.
I'm David Hunter.
I'm Seth Juniac.
Yeah, we're not that important. But anyways, let's talk about some things that just recently happened. Avengers Age of Ultron just came out. I finally saw the movie, so we could finally talk about it compared to last week where... Well, I guess you weren't here, David. You know what? I realized, I told everyone in the podcast that you were not here because you reenacted the ending scene from Halo 3 because you love Halo. But I actually realized that there's something more important you've been actively trying to do. You weren't here because you're trying to be an extra in a Nick Cage movie.
Wow, I'm surprised you decided to share that so early. But yes, there is I'm not going to say I have pursued it yet, but there's apparently a Nicolas Cage movie happening nearby where I live at home, and... pretty interesting. It's over in Mobile, and he's doing a movie based off of the USS Indianapolis, if everybody remembers that horrible incident that happened in World War II.
No one alive remembers.
Please tell us about the USS Indianapolis.
I remember what happened.
I totally know what it is. I just, you know, I want the
I really don't
want
to give a history lesson. I'll sound really stupid having to explain that. I haven't taken history in about, you know, 6 years. But
won't it be important to know your part, though, like if you're going to be an extra in this movie?
I'm not going to really do any research, you know. I think I'm just going to, you know, be me. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to be me. And I'm from this area, so I kind of, I guess, know where everything is and kind of have an advantage over anybody that might be traveling around here. But going to test my acting chops.
So,
and hopefully I'll have a good conversation about Nicolas Cage.
So you're the Gollum that's leading the hobbits through the Mordor that is Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it's like down here. It's a total shithole. You know?
Yeah, no, TNT played the...
we all eat raw fish and we hate potato stew.
I'm in a certain frame of mind.
So eat raw fish and hate potato stew, you know, like Gollum did.
Okay, well, actually, the thing is, I actually know all about the USS Indianapolis because my dad's a big, like, World War II guy. There's actually, we have a full set of books about World War II that I would read as a kid. Mostly looked at the pictures because the planes look cool or whatever. But essentially, it was, like, considered the largest, like, losses of any, like, U.S. naval or whatever.
Yeah.
I think, like, 300 people died on the ship.
Obviously, everybody and, like, remembers rest, from Jaws whenever Quint made the big speech about his experiences on the USS Indianapolis. It was one of the bigger monologues in film.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Jaws. I kind of forgot about that because I haven't seen Jaws in a long time, but I know how much you love that movie.
No, yeah, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. But I think what my approach is when I'm going to be doing this audition is I'm going to take the Nicolas Cage approach of total, you know, submersion into my part. I'm going to do what he did. Like, I remember
submersion is a good word for a movie about ship sinking.
I'm glad about the old
I didn't mean any puns with that one. I didn't need any puns in that one.
Let us marvel at your pun.
Oh. Took me ages to get that one. But,
come on, you pun burglar.
Pun burglar.
We were talking about before the show that we just want to start off with like a pun war over Marvel Age of Ultron, and mine was something about colon. So.
But to kind of join the two stories together, I guess. I mean, I don't know if anyone heard the crazy Nicolas Cage story about what he did when he was preparing for the part in Ghost Rider. Have y'all heard that?
He killed people?
No, he didn't. He actually
He
actually sat in like a dark room and bought a bunch of like voodoo objects from around the New Orleans area. Like bought a bunch of a bunch of ancient artifacts.
See, really, what he's saying is he does it all the time already, but he wanted to like, you know, clarify why he did that to other people.
But apparently he would like sit there in like a dark room and like yell at himself in the mirror and make horrible faces and like paint his face and stuff to prepare for the part of Ghost Rider. I'm not even kidding you. It's one of the craziest stories I've heard.
Actors
Daniel Day-Lewis even like takes a step back and go, what the hell are you doing with that, man?
What do you think Edward Norton thinks about that?
He thinks it's stupid.
Jared Leto's like, really? You didn't inhabit some like in the middle of some nowhere swamp in Louisiana and become a part of their voodoo tribe? Like he didn't think he went far enough.
Jared Leto's the guy that's like, I'm not actually just a member of the voodoo tribe, I'm the chieftain.
I worked my way through the ranks over a series of years.
I spent
prepare
10
for the part.
Years for this role, just, you know, inhabiting the tribe and learning their ways. And I married one of them there. And
I have my own little kid.
all for one movie role.
And then after the movie wrapped, I was like, all right, bye, I'm leaving.
You guys. It's kind of like a Tropic Thunder, Robert Downey Jr.'s character.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, another fun fact about the USS Indianapolis, because, you know, we give history lessons.
I don't know
here,
if we
can actually
have fun facts about the USS Indianapolis. It was a pretty rough incident.
I mean,
is there such thing as a not fun fact, now that I think about it? Like, no one ever brings up a not fun fact.
Yeah, no one ever brings up, here's a fact for you. This will ruin your day.
It's like the Professor Hubert Farnsworth type of approach to things. Good news, everyone. We're all going to die.
Anyways. Interesting about the ship was it actually had just finished delivering part of the first atomic bomb, and then it got torpedoed. The Japanese were just a little bit too late.
That's not a fun fact at all, but all right, I'm glad I know now.
I would say they did their purpose before it got torpedoed, so that's something they can at least, you know, hold their hats high of. I mean, it's a sad event, obviously, but, you know, they did their job. That's commendable.
But so if I get a chance to, let's say, meet Nicolas Cage in this audition, or when I go to try to become an extra, and if I actually make it, which I'm confident I will, I have pretty good acting chops. But what would be the question that you would have me ask Nicolas Cage? What would be the question you would have me ask?
What question would I want you to ask him? It's kind
of
interesting.
And you can't say, have you gotten out of your gambling debt yet? Don't say that yet. That's not a good icebreaker question.
My question would be is, like, what are you? That's really the question I'd ask. What are you?
An actor? Because I don't really see it.
You good? Are you bad? Are you human? These are things I'm not entirely sure with him.
You should be like, I saw Leaving Las Vegas, and you won an Academy Award. It was one of the best movies and performances I've ever seen. What happened, man?
I don't know, man. I thought The Sorcerer's Apprentice, he was really good in that.
Yeah. I never saw that.
You never saw that? Jeez, okay.
But it was good? You liked it? Really? To be honest?
No, I mean, it was a Disney B movie. What do you expect?
National Treasure was pretty good, I thought.
I would be like, so I saw Leaving Las Vegas, and then I decided to watch Ghost Rider. I don't understand.
Did you do it, actually? Did you actually do that?
I did do that, because I was like, okay, this is kind of interesting. And then I was like, wow. And because Ghost Rider is a bad movie, but at least it's like somewhat kind of enjoyable while being bad.
I was just to say it's watchable, I think.
It's like better than the sequel, Spirit of Vengeance. That one was terrible.
Did you guys see Bangkok Dangerous?
No.
It's another terrible movie that's also like not like
with a name like Bangkok Dangerous. How is it a terrible movie?
I mean, it is.
It
sounds like an old exploitation, like eighties B movie title right there. Bangkok Dangerous.
It's like he's like a hitman who falls in love. Or something, and like they tried to make him look kind of Asian, which is probably the biggest misstep.
Oh my god!
Which actually makes it kind of funny.
Ugh, man.
Nicolas Cage.
Do you think they actually like said, all right, let's make him look kind of Asian, or do you think Nicolas Cage is like, I have to submerge myself into this culture, and so I have to make myself Asian to blend
in?
I ate nothing but lo mein for a month. I'm ready.
He started off by like. He's probably so poor right now, and so, you know, he's so poor with the movies that he keeps on spending all of his money. He's probably eating ramen to like submerge to join the culture there.
And then you see Jared Leto over there in like a Nike sweatshop, you know, just trying to get himself ready.
But yeah, we should probably do a Nicolas Cage podcast at some point.
Yeah, I'll
just like a pure podcast.
No. No.
He's certainly one of the more intriguing characters, I think, in Hollywood, so to speak. One of the ones.
There's actually a South Park episode about where they can't decide whether he's good or bad, and that's like the whole point.
I mean, exactly. I mean, that's how it is. You don't know if he's a good actor or a bad actor. Like, he does terrible movies, but then like his earlier career, he was terrific.
Yeah, I'd buy that, but you know, it's the kind of thing where I just want to see him do a role that's actually good. You know,
I want to see him have self-respect. True. Kick-Ass, he almost played a parody of himself, though. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, no,
the way I see it is,
funny,
he is not Nicolas Cage.
It's funny how good Kick-Ass was, though. Like,
I do like Kick-Ass a lot, but by the way, it's not that he's not Nicolas Cage. He's Academy Award-winning Nicolas Cage. Just remember that, guys.
Yes,
speaking of Aaron Tyler Johnson, though, let's go ahead and make this transition to the...
We need the segue soon.
Yeah, speaking of Aaron Tyler Johnson, I thought he was the weakest part of the movie.
Oh, let's talk real quick. Before we get into this movie at all... We are going to spoiler things of Avengers Age of Ultron, so if you haven't seen the movie yet, go skip forward about 15 minutes arbitrarily.
Turn away.
I don't know.
All right. Yeah,
but if you haven't seen it by now, then, I mean, I don't know why you're even listening.
Yeah.
That's a little harsh, Seth.
Yeah, get the hell out of here. Don't listen. But yeah, anyways, for spoilers, he definitely was probably the weakest part, and Joss Whedon knew. That's why he killed him off.
No, he didn't kill him off. He got Whedoned.
So I have a question. Is he really that bad, or is Quicksilver so awesome in X-Men Days of Future Past that in comparison he seems really bad?
Yeah, I think that might be more of what it was. I'm kind of surprised that they didn't just, you know, stick with the same actor, but I guess these are notably different. Evan Peters was the guy who did it in X-Men Days of Future Past.
Well, you can't have the same actor if they're two different
lines. Yeah, and I understand that, but it was still kind of...
Incidentally, they're both in Kick-Ass, which we talked about earlier. Ooh, coincidences.
Sure. Like, what is it? I think that's like where the age, like the casting director or whatever is like, get me the guy from Kick-Ass, and then they get Mary Tyler Johnson. Shit, wrong
one. Get me the other guy from Kick-Ass. Yeah, exactly.
Before we, there's a lot of things I know, David, that you particularly don't like about this movie. And before we get to negative stuff, let's talk about the positive things. And I want to start off by saying I absolutely love, my favorite part of the movie was probably the early on party. Because one, you had War Machine or Don Cheadle telling that story to them, and neither, you know, the other superheroes were impressed at all.
No,
so
when
he's
funny.
Later come back to him telling the story to random people who all laugh a lot. He's like so proud of himself for that story.
Yeah, everyone focuses on his face too, and he gives that expression of just like, yeah, that's right, I got it this time.
I think including Don Cheadle was one of the best things they did, because he is a part of that universe, even though he really wasn't in, you know, movies that much, except Iron Man 2.
I don't know, I think that Don Cheadle's a very underrated actor just in general. I mean, I
don't think he's underrated. He gets nominated for an Emmy every single year for a not very good television show.
True enough, but it's also a thin category in, you know, comedy.
And as a film actor, I think he's better. I mean, if you separate film actors from television actors, I think he is underrated when it comes to the films he does. The thing I remember him probably most for, though, is his role in the Ocean's 11 series. I thought he was fairly good in that with his outrageous accent that he uses.
And now I'm convinced that for every bank heist movie ever, the explosive guy has to be British.
Yep.
But I like the party a lot because of something that you know, we've talked and we've disagreed in the past about like how we need happy scenes to kind of, I think that the happy scenes and scenes like that kind of establish the status quo and, you know, stuff like that and give the follows is at a different baseline. So I mean, I think that a scene like this in terms of you know, outside of being absolutely entertaining.
No, definitely. I mean, I agree there. I think that maybe where this movie kind of loses me, though, when I'll talk about things I didn't like, is I think they kind of peppered those in too much to where it almost became tonally jarring. Because you had these complicated, interesting, you know, interesting kind of darker concepts with the artificial intelligence aspect of Ultron and how that plays into society and how that plays into the world that the Avengers live in and how it's going to – and how they're going to fit that into their – into their purpose. And I think the movie kind of constantly tries to give you those one-liners to remind you, oh, this is an Avengers movie, this is, you know, a Joss Whedon, this is my clever dialogue. And it kind of became a little bit tonally jarring for me after a while of how much they just peppered it in there.
Speaking off that, right, I want to get this out there. I enjoyed the movie, but in a lot of the ways I enjoyed the movie is because my expectations were already set by everyone else who already saw it, so I know it wasn't going to be this amazing thing. In that regard, I was just going to enjoy it. But I think I'm with you because I hate some of the things they did in the movie. Like Hawkeye, I like how they made Hawkeye a more established character, and yet the way they just tried to, like, I guess the emotional resonance they tried to do from the family just seems so typical of any kind of movie nowadays, to the point that I was kind of like, you know, in a movie when Hawkeye went to go save a little boy, I'm like, oh, of course he's going to go try to save the little boy, yeah. And then someone's going to die saving him. I knew that was going to happen. Either he was going to die, or someone's going to die saving him.
I
figured he wouldn't die.
I feel like it was kind of an overcorrection, though, because I think one of the criticisms of the Avengers as a whole is how do Black Widow and how do Hawkeye look like good people next to these superhuman ability-powered things? But they made him integral, you know, when the Scarlet Witch is taking everyone, he's the only one that doesn't take it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's actually a really strong thing, and they establish why he's necessary.
No, I definitely
I think
I mean, sorry, Billy. You want to go
first?
I think of the two, they definitely established what is necessary, but I think they did a much better job making Black Widow seem interesting and integral to the story. Hawkeye, yeah, he does some things, but, like, it's most of his screen time happened to be very heavily involved with his family and things of his family, and even the whole scene with Scarlet Witch, you know, it still doesn't really compare to what these other people are doing.
Yeah, and to my understanding, though, I guess for full disclosure, it's my understanding that this is a scene that Marvel and Whedon kind of argued over.
Yeah. I mean, it was. I read that as well. The home scene where he's with his family, he really wanted that. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes. The home scene. Actually, the Thor Vision Quest, we'll call it.
That's when they really argued over.
That's when they really argued over, and Marvel won, and Whedon won the Brenner at home thing. And I kind of wish it was the other way. I wanted to see more of Thor's universe than Hawkeye's universe. I kind of wish it was not even like Hawkeye's universe
as much as just like, oh, he's got a family. They create some kind of emotional resonance, which just doesn't really work super well in a movie.
I mean,
it's one of those typical things you'd expect.
I think I liked those scenes for part of the reason why I liked those scenes, whenever I did like them and to the extent I did, was the fact that they made the film more self-aware of the fact that Hawkeye is kind of out of place in this group of Avengers and these group of superheroes. It kind of lays the ground for like, all right, well, he does understand his limitations in this, and his family's worried about him because of his limitations in this, but they actually do kind of need him for reasons that I think were valid.
One thing I will say, though, I thought that I just really liked how Jeremy Renner played the whole thing. I thought he was a really solid part, but even the home scenes don't bother me that much because we got to see just how out of place Iron Man and Captain America and all these guys are in this universe. But like, as the audience, that's what we relate to. That's our baseline. And it was just kind of funny seeing how out of place they were.
Did anybody else crack up when they just saw Iron Man or Tony Stark, and you saw Captain America? I guess Steve Rogers is his real name. But they were out in the back just chopping wood together randomly in the movie.
Don't touch my pile.
Like, I just thought it was hilarious. Just why are these guys just sitting there chopping wood?
You know what my favorite thing about
in the middle
this movie
of summer.
Is like, I think what I love about this movie is when you get like two of these because all the actors in the movie are phenomenal. We have guys like Mark Ruffalo and Robert Downey Jr. in this movie, or Jeremy Renner. Like, these are all guys who've been nominated for Oscars, and that's ignoring like Scarlett Johansson, who's phenomenal stuff. And it's like watching my favorite scenes are probably watching Robert Downey Jr. convince Mark Ruffalo, Iron Man, Tony Stark convincing Bruce Banner to go along with every one of his ideas. It's always probably the most entertaining part of both those scenes are one of the most entertaining parts of the whole movie to me.
Definitely. I mean,
we're mad scientists. We gotta go for it.
The Whedon dialogue for me in this whole movie was probably the biggest strength and the biggest weakness of everything that was involved with this film. I mean, the overstuffing of the one-liners and the wit kind of came off a little bit strong for me. But when it comes to the actual character interactions, I mean, he nailed it once again, just like he did with the Avengers. I mean, it was perfect.
I'm just gonna agree to disagree here. I think that the wit, the dialogue, it's part of the comic book feel to me. A lot of the comic books I've read, that's how they are.
But I will say that what I noticed was watching Fast and Furious going to this, all the one-liners and like that was much more handleable compared to a movie like Fast and Furious where it's just kind of awful.
Yeah.
That's fair. I mean, I kind of understand what you mean in terms of the comic book aspect, and yeah, that's true. But I guess it's just kind of a preference, so to speak.
It's not like the Gilligan where it's very economical with the words. Every word has a meaning. This is one that it's almost completely of throwaway lines because the action drives it.
Yeah, it's just kind of funny because I feel like every single one of these characters has the same sense of humor. They all have that Whedon, like all of his characters always have that Whedon dry sense of humor in his
stuff.
And that's fine. It's kind of his stamp. It's his trademark, and he can use that. But it is kind of funny to see all these guys that seem so different in terms of their characters, but then they all kind of share that same crass, dry sense of humor.
Well, let's talk about really the best part of this movie, and that is Ultron's probably the coolest, in some ways, most wasted, character or villain we've seen in a Marvel movie in a while.
I know that Seth doesn't necessarily think that he's wasted, right, Seth? You were telling me that you feel like it benefited him as being a presence off-screen.
Well, I just think that that's sometimes the sign of a good villain is his presence felt when he's not on the screen. And I thought ultimately, and a lot of this is just the way it was written and way it was directed, they're always reacting to how he is. They're always either running away from him, running towards him. And a lot of that is because of how charismatic he was when he was on screen. We understand why they're in fear. We understand why they're, springing to action.
But this is where I kind of disagree, because when I say that I think he was wasted, I don't mean in terms of how they use him within this movie. I'm, again, sort of like how much.
You mean we should have seen more of him?
No, I'm saying that for the movie, for this character, right, they could have truly made something absolutely special and fantastic that you really couldn't get out of any other Marvel movie, probably. And they kind of wasted it. They kind of used it for a lesser story. and it's a very, you know, strong lesser story. I really enjoyed this movie, but it could have been so much more, and I think that's where most of your frustration of this movie come from, David.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's you put it, you know, you hit it right on the head with that. That's exactly where I kind of stand with this movie. I feel like the themes that they were tackling were very compelling, very complex with artificial intelligence and kind of the, especially the relationship between Tony Stark and Ultron and kind of Ultron at that, especially that beginning scene, if you remember, where Jarvis and Ultron are kind of interacting and how Jarvis is explaining to Ultron what he is and what his purpose is. And Ultron's kind of questioning all these things because it's kind of it's a literal intelligence, a literal digital consciousness. And it's kind of, I just would like to see a movie that would tackle that on a satisfying level for me. And I feel like Ex Machina might be that movie that I want to go see recently. That's out. That I'm
actually
that,
almost
but,
yeah, I almost saw that movie, but I saw Furious 7, which was
I mean Chappie certainly didn't do it for me.
What about Robin was, Williams art, you know, AI and like your Bicentennial Man is what it was, the Robin
talk
Williams
about well yeah it, we'll talk about a really strange movie that was, but I mean it kind of but we'll talk about that on a later day, I suppose. But yeah,
you tried to get me to see Chappie with you because the idea of the movie seemed so cool, and I was like, David, every review of this movie makes it sound like it's awful, and yet you still saw it.
Yeah, it was bad. You're right. It was real bad. But yeah, I mean, Ultron, I mean, I feel like it could have dealt with that, and it would have been interesting to see that handled within a comic book universe in terms of that sort of style.
I understand completely what you're saying, and if this were an Avengers tale in a vacuum, it might have accomplished that. But because this, you know, in all of these superhero movies, as part of a bigger picture, you know, this is part of the Avengers trajectory as a whole. As a single standalone movie, it had to check off so many criteria. It had to be so many things. It had to be a bridge for basically five movies. So
it is kind of a difference between approaches. You have, let's say, you know, the Nolan Batman films. I'm just throwing it out there as an example, which kind of execute each one of them on an individual level and don't really try to build towards anything.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. That's its own separate three-episode story, to where it didn't have to cater to being part of the Justice League. It didn't have to do this, that, or the other thing. And
so then you look at Avengers, and it's kind of the opposite. It's each one of these things is building towards an overall direction for the universe. It's the difference between the world building and in both of those separate, you know, franchises.
And it's actually kind of interesting, Seth. You're making the point how the movie was the way it was, and partly because it's more closely related to the comics. But if this were the comics, like an Ultron story in the comics, it would probably be a lot more complex, unique story from what we want on this character. But you're right, it only has to build toward the larger story, which is eventually going to be the Infinity War.
Which is the
and
confrontation kinda, with Thanos, pretty much. And,
yeah, which as they led
and before
to the
that,
end of the movie,
Civil War, correct. Obviously. Civil War is the next big
which I'm not looking
to
forward
happen.
To at all.
Really?
I'm really not. I think, yeah, the way they, first of all, the way they set it up at the end of this movie was pretty clear, like they're building toward the Civil War. And second, I don't want to see, when you have Thanos at the end of the movie, you know, Thanos, like, he's like, you know, like, okay, I guess I'll do it myself, and it's so awesome and cool. I don't want to wait 4 years for that, or 3 years, whatever it is. I don't want to see two heroes, you know, their sides kind of fighting each other in conflict that you know is going to be resolved.
It depends, it depends to me if it's really, if this Civil War is really going to have an overall, you know, long-lasting impact on the universe. Is it really going to divide them, and that's what it's going to do? Or is it going to divide them and then reunite them, and it's going to end up being a bunch of filler?
That's what it's
going to
do, because it's a, you know, it's Disney. It's a Disney Marvel movie. And also, like, if you – the comic book story of it, which I talked to my dad a long time about it because I'm kind of disappointed with the idea, and he loved that storyline, is very cool. But it's something that's kind of built way better for the comic books than the actual movie itself. Like, Marvel X-Men Days of Futures Past, right? One of the more unique and interesting comic book stories maybe ever done, which is why my dad still swears by that movie. That's why Seth, I think, likes me a lot, is the idea of it and the story is so cool.
Well,
I don't think they execute it very well.
And see, that's the thing is that, you know, I guess I'll sit there and defend it, you know, if we're going to frame it like that. I think the thing that's so fascinating about it is because, look, it's kind of very blatant, and look, we want to reboot, and this is us going to reboot it. And in terms of a movie describing its own parameters and describing its own objective, I don't think I've seen, as you know, at least a superhero movie that does it better than X-Men Days of Future Past.
And like I said, the idea of it is so cool, and that's why, like, you know, Civil War is like, okay, in a vacuum, this sounds like a good idea, but it's just not going to work for what they've been doing. And I guess I'm not that surprised. All these movies that have come out, like, in kind of stage two outside of Guardians of the Galaxy have played a little safe, in my opinion.
To give Days of Future Past, I guess, it's fair due. My problems with it lie on it being on, like, a film basis and just having a problem with the way that the narrative worked and the way it was, I guess, edited kind of bothered me, or maybe not the editing, but just there's some aspects of it that just kind of bothered me on a film basis. But in terms of a reboot, it as well as, you know, the Star Trek movies, I appreciate them because they're not lazy reboots. They actually try to wove it into a story that we understand and into a and appreciate, you know, the previous arcs that have happened in the franchise.
But, did you guys love First Class as a reboot?
First Class was a good reboot, but this is the one where the thing that's fascinating and what makes this different is, you know, Patrick Stewart is handing the torch out to James McAvoy.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I like that. Yeah.
Ian McKellen is giving Fassbender the keys. That's kind of what makes it different than, you know, the Star Trek reboot, or why I don't even consider First Class a pure spiritual reboot.
The idea is, like, I get it being good as a reboot, right?
That's what I feel.
And it being a good story concept is not the same as it working effectively as a movie.
That's fair, but I thought it was an enjoyable movie outside of, I agree with David, you know, the motivations basically being, Professor X feeling sorry for, you know, Mystique. I mean, that's basically what drives the whole story. That's the motivation for the whole story.
And I don't like that part at all. I don't like the whole stuff in the future, too. I don't like the fact that, hey, I know, let's bring Storm because Halle Berry. Oh, we'll give Magneto a scene because he could be here, I guess. It makes sense.
You gotta give those guys a send-off, though.
Yeah, that's the kind of
thing. It's not a send-off. It's just like, hey, let's bring him back here. Come on. What about everyone else in the franchise? They just bring those. I think they did that kind of like a, it's cool if they're here. Star power.
Sure. But, you know, I think that also that has something to do with, you know, again, spiritually, you know, you guys have given your all to this franchise. It's time for us to reboot it, and we prefer your backing, you know?
Did they give it their all, though?
I don't know. That's not for me to say.
It still just reminds me of the awful Storm line about what happens to a frog or toad Storm? Was struck by lightning or whatever?
What was the line?
I can't remember. It was like you guys know what I'm talking about, right? In the first X-Men movie, it was like, what happens to a frog struck by lightning? The same thing happens to
Hey, man, there's no bad line that'll ever stack up to Hayden Panettiere and as Anakin Skywalker in Attack of the Clones going, I don't like sand.
I love how my joke about him being Hayden Panettiere has made everyone just say that instinctively and not Hayden Christensen now.
No, I mean, I said it on purpose
as a
joke.
I still love Arnold Schwarzenegger as what killed the dinosaurs, the Ice Age.
Yeah, that too. I love myself a bad line every now and then. I mean, even a movie that I thought was really great, you know, Interstellar had a bad line for me, at least.
What is it? The bad line to make all bad lines, Imitation Game, you know, why do bullies bully or whatever it was.
Oh, wow, that movie. So I saw the movie with Seth in the theater, and that was one of the more entertaining in terms of, like, how corny and weinsteiny that movie was. That even though certain elements are very kind of entertaining and rewarding as a spectator, it was like the lines about the bullying were so bad all the time. And actually, that maybe made me question Benedict Cumberbatch's potential as an actor.
Yeah, no, he was.
And then you watch Sherlock again, right?
Oh, but even then, like, Sherlock, like, it's like kind of a similar character, actually, in a weird sort of way.
Well, Doctor Strange is a similar character in a weird sort of way. So, I don't know. Cumberbatch still gets me, you know, just because I like what he is and like what he does. I'm just not really sure if I'm ever going to want more. If I am going to want more, I that's where I go into your territory, Billy. I question whether he can give me more.
So is Doctor Strange, is he going to be incorporated in the next Avengers movie?
I don't think he's part of the Avengers, you know, just Avengers. Oh, yeah, he is. I lied. Don't listen to me.
Is he going to play, like, his own
part separate from the rest of the Marvel Universe? He's going to be in Infinity War. He's going to be in Infinity
War.
Okay,
cool. Good thing. 100% thank God we somehow managed to segue back into the Avengers off of that.
Which, you know, by the way, when we talk about X-Men Days of Future Past, we didn't talk, you know, about Peter Dinklage, how bad he was, but he's also awesome in Game of Thrones. Whoa! Segue!
He's
now
great
we're segueing.
Destiny.
Yes, he is. No, shut up.
So bad. Where do I go next, Dinklebot?
Shut up, stupid? Isn't that what we were going to say?
Yeah, so we're on a Skype right now, right? And we made a joke that, like, if someone's interrupting whatever, just say shut up, stupid, for everything. But also, David's Skype avatar right now is one of the splatter symbol from Halo, because of course it is. Of course it is.
It was one of my badges that I took back from my real-life excursion into the Halo 3 reenactment scene.
Oh, man.
It was my badge of honor I took back.
So how did you do the Cortana scenes in your reenactment?
I took a bunch of acid and just kind of wandered around in the Jeep. And so, I mean, it does kind of feel that way when you were playing that game and you were going through there, like Master Chief was tripping on acid or something when he's getting these Cortana flashes through his visor.
You know, Seth would know about this if he had played Halo 3 or Halo 4. I guess even or Halo 4, really. I'm just going to add that in there because, you know, my opinion's invalid for not playing Halo 2.
It is.
But
technically both of your opinions are invalid.
Now we're on the 14th of 15 episodes in Halo 2, so the minute we continue playing again, we'll be right into Halo 3.
Good deal.
Who's we? Are you playing with someone?
The royal we.
Yes. The royal we. King Turd.
The Game of Thrones episode this week, Kill the Boy, which I was kind of fascinated why it was called Kill the Boy, which obviously goes back to Jon Snow needing to get rid of his, you know, younger self and, you know, mature as a man, which is kind of a creative way of doing that, because it could have been anything. You know, it could have been Kill the Little Boy, you know, that's helping Jon Snow out, you know, his ward. But I like the way this episode, the last couple of weeks, they've been building toward, and this is spoilers, by the way, everyone, that should be obvious when we talk about Game of Thrones, but... and that's, they probably already know all the spoilers for the most part because all the book readers probably spoiled it. But
I like the way the episodes have been out for like months.
Oh yeah, exactly. So I like the way they are building with the you know, talking about Valyria, mentioning, you know, Grayscale, and that kind of led kind of wonderfully into them going on like a little boat tour into Valyria, and the Snowmen appeared. I like the way they built up to that moment so it didn't feel as fake. Even though I'm still kind of laughing at the idea, like, oh no. Stone Men. It just sounds kind of ridiculous, but yeah. It's still
I feel like it was much better handled than the Deus Ex Machina at the end of Season 4 with the fairies that attacked, remember? That attacked Bran Stark and his guide and Hoegdor and all
Look,
them.
Nothing about Bran does not seem crazy, okay? That's the point.
I know, I'm just saying,
magic,
I feel like...
David, just go with it.
I felt like using some sort of supernatural element and like just randomly incorporating it, I feel like it was better served in this episode where they attacked Jorah and Tyrion.
Though. This is a fantasy show. We forget about it.
But it's a fantasy show because the family dynamics
are the most engaging part. I mean, we forget that it is a fantasy show. There's dragons. There's fire. There's magic. There's zombies that are, you know, going to kill everyone before too long.
I just like those moments to feel earned by the story, if you know what I mean by that. Like, I like the way they earned this moment with the, you know, the discussions of the grayscale and the disease and showing that does exist within this universe. Then when they're wandering through a bone field and fairies attack them. I felt like they did it. And
they did a good job leading up to it, though.
I know they did a good job leading up to it, but that's not really earning it. Like, they led up to it because, you know, the previous two episodes, they mentioned both the things, you know? I mean...
Yes, but, you know, that character has been there for a long time, and we've wondered what was exactly going on with her. I mean, it felt like this was something that was present in the story for a longer period and woven into it a little bit better to me, personally.
No, that's fine.
By the way, you guys want to hear a fun thing from the book that cannot possibly happen in the show because they killed off the character?
Who, Barristan, you mean?
No, it's about Jojen.
Okay,
so there's this thing in the book that's not been confirmed, but this is what happened with how weird that storyline gets and what happens. But anyways, so Jojen, you know, he can see the future, right? And that's part of his, you know, character. And after he got to, like, the Great Hollow Tree or whatever, I don't even know what it's called, honestly. I can't remember because I ignore the brand stuff. I don't like it that much. But after he gets there, he starts acting really weird, right? And he's kind of, like, being very, like, pessimistic, and like, he's really down all the time. And they say they think it's because he knows when he's going to die. Like, he knew in the future when he was going to die, right? And then at some point, you don't see Jojen anymore, and Bran is fed this, like, soup that would help unlock his power that has, like, bone-looking pieces in it, you know? And it seems like it could be made of flesh or whatever. So people think these weird fairy things have ever fed Jojen... I mean, fed Bran Jojen as part of the way to unlock his powers.
It's metal.
I feel like that would not work very well in the show, so like, they just kill him off.
It's metal,
you know what's
though?
Funny? What's funny is you could have literally said anything nonsensical there whatsoever, and I wouldn't have been able to really challenge you. So you could have told me something that was completely not from the book.
Ned Stark comes back to life as Godzilla.
And I would have just been like, wow, that's interesting, Billy.
There's actually some things
I wonder why
like
they changed that.
There's actually some things that happen, like, in the
And this time he's played by Nicolas Cage.
Like, there's some weird stuff that happens later on that has not, you know, come back yet, and I keep sitting here wondering if it's ever going to happen, because it's stuff that's not necessarily necessary, but it's kind of cool and weird. But maybe that's why, I don't know, they're kind of a little more grounded, and they're kind of going their own path, and this season's kind of fascinating in the way that they're kind of away from the books, and they've been kind of going in their own direction. I don't really know how some of these storylines are going to happen, but I don't know, it's kind of weird. Episode 5 made me start to wonder about this season. In the way of, like, what's going to happen moving forward. Is it really just building to the Winterfell, like, battle, I guess? Is that really, like, and I guess obviously you have stuff going on at King's Landing, but I went from very optimistic to kind of, like, I guess cautious now about what to expect this season.
It's really kind of funny how you vacillated, because I thought episode 4 was the best of the season, and then season 5, all of a sudden, you're curious again.
Well, yeah, just, wait, I don't, you know, what are they building toward, right? Episode 4 was phenomenal, but even if the shows are, episodes are phenomenal, there's got to be some kind of, you know, it can't just work as a show. And I love the parts that are more, like, dialogue-based, more political-based,
right.
You know, more than
like that. Tyrion hasn't had much of a chance to do that.
Yeah, but like, I just don't know what they're going to do, and that kind of worries me a little bit. And that, maybe that's because I don't know, but also because they haven't really built toward much.
Well, the one thing I will say, though, you talk about those political, you know, those political dialogue-heavy scenes. Probably my least favorite, yet favorite scene at the same time was Sansa's dinner with Ramsay and the Boltons.
Yeah, everyone in that room had killed one of her siblings.
Yeah, that was, yeah, you know, that was kind of funny, and that dramatic irony was great. But like, for some reason, you know, the same Sansa that was, you know, in the crypt talking with Littlefinger, am I going to seduce him or am I going to kill him? All of a sudden now is kind of having cold feet and is kind of timid now and isn't owning the moment, you know?
It's kind of hard to own the moment, though, in a room surrounded by Boltons.
That's true. But
like, I mean, I would be intimidated by, especially, like, we talk about Ramsay all the time. David thinks Ramsay's a better villain than Joffrey. He's wrong, but we don't need to get into that.
You don't want to give me my little monologue here?
No, because you're wrong.
I don't get my spotlight.
No, it's wrong. Anyways, Roose Bolton is such an intimidating, scary, intriguing character with such a terrifying actor. The way he just stares at you and just, like, peers into your soul, you know. And I don't blame the way Sansa acts. I mean, that's how I would act in that situation.
No, yeah, and I just think that, you know, it's a slight relapse, you know, in terms of the independent, strong woman that she was coming into it.
But I don't think she really had that. I don't think she really had that necessarily as much as what she's, like, trying to do. You know, Littlefinger's guiding.
You know, what is it? Littlefinger dropped the line, dyeing your hair doesn't change who you are.
Yeah.
Was the line.
I mean, she had a pity fit like 2 episodes ago about the idea of marrying Ramsay, remember?
Yeah.
Right.
She hasn't exactly grown that much.
I mean, I think maybe she's just one of those characters that was meant to be the way she is, but the situations she's being thrust in is kind of forcing her to adapt to something that she really doesn't really have in her. Like, she's not good at those things. She's not supposed to be that way. And she's struggling to handle those sort of that.
Well, it's interesting to see how the Chekhov's candle in the tower. Chekhov's gun's a saying, but I'm gonna call it Chekhov's candle in the tower because Brienne got it like
sure,
set
sure.
up. So the servant delivered the message to Sansa, who said, "Light a candle in the Winterfell's highest tower if she needs help." The tower that obviously, you know, started the whole show of Bran getting pushed out of it.
Yeah, that's true. That is an interesting.
What was going on when Bran went up there? Did like something like normal happen up there? Well, that Bran saw. What was it again? Oh yeah, it was incest in the first episode.
That really set the tone for what kind of show this was going to be.
It really did. We're gonna have incest and push a little boy out of a tower.
But we're not
Thrones,
gonna have
guys.
Cannibal soup. But apparently, cannibal soup goes too far.
It's too weird.
Yeah, cannibal soup goes too far.
Jojen soup, as they call it, it's such a... There's actually a lot of fun theories are out there, but that's probably my fave in terms of, like, George R. R. Martin is a sick bastard.
So what do you all think about Arya's adventures right now?
Well, we didn't see her this season, so it's tough to... We didn't see her this episode, so it's kind of tough, but it's got to lead to something. I kind of like how this season is kind of starting to delve into religious ideologies, and I think that, Arya's arc, I guess is the word I'm looking for, is a very fascinating way to delve into it, but I'm not sure exactly what her endgame is just yet.
I thought it was kind of a very on-the-nose...
To kill everyone
on
her list,
It was an on-the-nose thing, but it worked with her having to throw away all of her belongings and, like, throw away her past to become something new in her identity. I mean, it was a little bit on-the-nose, but, you know, I liked it. I thought it was interesting.
Well, it was even more on-the-nose that she kept her sword, meaning she didn't
actually
throw everything away.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, you weren't here last week, David. We talked about Game of Thrones for about 37 minutes. My favorite thing about episode 4, right? Of all,
I don't really listen
I love
to
that
the
episode.
Show.
I figured not. But episode 4, right? There's a part where Cersei's in the chamber talking small council, and she's like, "Lord Tyrell, this is very important. How about you go to Braavos? And, Meryn Trant, you should go with him." And it's hilarious watching, you know, obviously seeing anything with Lord Tyrell because he's such a bumbling idiot. But I love how they're sending Meryn Trant to Braavos just so Arya can kill him because he's on his list and most people don't even know who he is.
No, that
like,
is...
the entire point of them going to Braavos is so she can kill Meryn Trant,
I mean,
which
it's
I think
pretty
is kind
obvious.
Of funny. Yeah. And the way they set up is just kind of really funny. Some kind of interesting things, I guess, happened this season. Actually, I mean, obviously, let's talk about the grayscale, I guess. Mm-hmm. Jorah has grayscale. What does that mean moving forward?
It means the Tyrion's probably going to die.
Tyrion's probably going
to
die.
Well, I think no, that's a very safe prediction. 100%.
All men must die. Valor Morghulis.
Well, it's just kind of, I'm going to, you know, in script writing, usually when you want, beginning, middle, end, and usually urgency helps bring things along. So now that Jorah has grayscale, all of a sudden Tyrion has an urgency to get to, you know, where Dany is. So,
right.
And then, as seen by a trailer and by the end of last episode, it's very possible that Jorah will end up in a pit.
Yeah.
It may not be a fighting pit, but it could be.
Yeah, no,
I think we should.
Can I say one of my favorite little moments of that last episode? I love the amount of wonder that was in Tyrion's eyes when he saw the dragon. That was something
that was
a very small thing and might not have, you know, warranted into much. But like that one little scene, just I thought was so brilliantly acted, because I thought that Peter Dinklage was so amazing.
Back to like his character in season one, where he wanted to see the wall just because he wanted to see the wall.
Yeah.
And piss off the edge of it, obviously, because you know that's important.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's very big.
Giant wall, you gotta piss
walls.
Off the edge of it. Like it's a
or
requirement.
A small wall in a brothel, you know, whatever wall works.
Or a wall in your room. If there's a wall, in fact, anywhere, you just need to piss on it, right? You're like a
frankly,
dog.
Frankly, secreting fluid out of that, you know, body part is just really important to him, and he'll do it in any way he can.
God, could you have just put it in any worse of a way? Secreting the fluid. Oh my God. But
by the way, you want to hear my random thing that I saw this episode that I know is going to lead to something in the future, but so minor most people don't realize it. Last week I went about the crypts and how important that scene was.
It is.
I loved watching. I mean, you say that now, Seth, that you heard me talk about it, and then you listen to the Watch the Thrones podcast, but don't act like you knew before that.
Oh no, a lot of Googles later, I now know that that was really important, and I had no idea. Partly because I was multitasking while watching it, and another
it's
part
almost,
of you know.
I'm not going to talk about it, but if you read the first book and you're looking for it, it becomes very obvious. But that's not important. Let's move on. Anyway, so watching Sam talk to Gilly about, you know, him wanting to become a maester in Old Town, that is this week's scene that's going to lead to something else that you wouldn't realize it.
Really?
Yeah, that's a kind of an interesting scene that kind of means more than this. Because Old Town is one of those places they've mentioned, I think, twice now this season. And it's a little more interesting that they haven't really. They're not going to. I mean, they'll go into it in future, but that's just for now. And I think that was kind of interesting. Like, they're very good at bringing up things and then showing it later. As we talked about, you know, with the Stone Men coming out.
Definitely, definitely. It's definitely one of the strong suits of this show.
We were going to talk about the Daredevil a little more this week because I just finished it. You know, David's been watching it more, and Seth finished it when we did the last podcast on Daredevil.
I haven't finished.
Seth's
like
been finished for months.
Now.
That's what I said. Like,
he's been
I mean,
starving to death waiting on us.
Hey, guys, I want to talk about Daredevil on the next podcast. Me finishes it. Them barely get past episode 3. Wasn't it great?
This is the best show I've ever seen.
Okay, so it's kind of funny. You're right, though, in the sense that we all really like the show, and yet it took me and David. David's not even done yet, but it took me like another like 2 months to finish it, you know? And a lot of it's just because, you know, when the school going on then was a busy time with finals and graduation and blah, blah, blah,
and
you finished it.
The funniest part, though, let me just throw this out there. The funniest part is that David, who hasn't seen it, spoiled it for you, not me.
I know.
The guy who had
right?
it spoiled it for you.
Because he assumed I had gotten to a part of the episode that I had not gotten to, and I don't appreciate that. Even though it's fine, it's not a big deal.
No, I mean, I feel bad. Spoiling is probably one of the worst things you can do to someone.
Well,
now
that I've seen every episode, you haven't, David, you better tread carefully.
I'll tread lightly.
Especially with The Wire. Do you want me to spoil anything from The Wire?
No. We're going to have like a Walter White, Hank Schrader, tread lightly confrontation here pretty soon.
Okay, what garage do you want to use?
I probably spoiled that for somebody right there. I'm spoiling left and right. Ugh.
Okay, we lost Seth again. We're just not going to worry about him, I guess, and just keep moving forward, unfortunately. Internet connections happen.
Yep.
But anyway, so...
Drama live on the air during the podcast.
Yeah,
previously
the podcast. Yeah, this is like the third time. This is why you don't trust Wi-Fi, kids. Anyway, so Fast and Furious. It's called Furious 7. I love the idea of trying to explain the titles to everybody. You showed me that Red Letter Media clip, which is really funny.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like it's called Fast 5, then Fast Furious 6, then Furious 7, so it's then The 8.
The next one's going to be called The 8. Like,
yeah. I mean, seriously, the difference between the first and fourth movie title is Fast and Furious and The Fast and Furious. That is pretty ridiculous. I will throw that out there, but I saw that
it's
movie.
Difficult.
And...
I mean, one of the guys on Red Letter Media for Half in the Bag was saying that he was going to try to catch up on the Fast and Furious before seeing the movie, but he saw the titles and he was just like, "Screw this! I'll just see if I can figure it out while I'm watching the eighth, while I'm watching the seventh installment of the movie."
So I really like that movie series for reasons I don't know why. I think Tokyo Drift's one of my favorite guilty pleasure movies. And I know that they're not the best movies, but Fast 5 was really good. Fast Furious 6, Fast Furious 6, that is the title. I wasn't even sure for a second.
Good guess.
was a very enjoyable movie. I thought I did a good job building off Fast 5. And then I got Furious 7, which compared to the other two was like intellectually a piece of turd, honestly. Like, I know it's supposed to be a stupid movie. I know they're supposed to have fun. But wow, the one-liners and the cheesy phrases and the fact that you really realize Vin Diesel's not that great of an actor versus The Rock, who's amazing, who's not in the movie enough.
Who could have easily taken that part and done well with it.
Well, seriously, this is The Rock's scenes in a nutshell, right? He has this awesome fight. He gets beat in a kind of crappy, cheesy way that was not like fist-fighting way. That was Jason Statham cheating, essentially, because of course Jason Statham's in the movie. And
Statham's the man, though.
He's back. Oh, hey, Seth, what's up? Yeah, I figured we'd just go out without you, because I was like, well, I don't even care anymore.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, we're glad you're here.
I waited 3 minutes before I, knew what you guys were talking about.
You see,
for what it's worth.
Despite this being a previously recorded show via a podcast, we're still having some drama and excitement going on live for our viewers. It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's like a Fast and Furious thing where I like, oh yeah, did someone call for the reinforcements or something?
Let's please talk about The Rock though. Like, he's in the hospital bed. He's like, daddy's gotta go to work, so he obviously flexes his biceps to break the cast, which is probably the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. He then crashes the ambulance of the ambulance van into the drone to destroy it. And then he gets out and picks up the minigun off the drone and starts firing away at another helicopter. It's like, this is like the most ridiculous thing I've seen.
But they love it.
Ever.
But it's the tone of
but
it
awesome,
makes it
yeah.
okay. The tone of it
and
makes it
And I love
it
because it's The Rock, too. The Rock could sell me on anything except San Andreas.
Also, we just need to see more. We just need to see more.
What's the movie called, guys? The one The Rock's in? The disaster one?
Yeah, San Andreas.
San Andreas? Yeah, I was right. Okay, yeah, I can't.
It's also a Grand Theft Auto game. Coincidence.
He's also been announced as Black Adam in the Shazam movie. That's going
Ooh.
To, be in 2019.
Oh, well, that's something I got to... At least I have something to live for that long. Life has a meaning now.
What about Mad Max, though, coming out this weekend? Me and David are the most excited people ever for this movie. That guy's universal acclaim, 97 Rotten Tomatoes, 80-something, high 80s Metacritic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super excited for it. I've been since the trailer. I mean, it fits the type of movie that I like. I like it, like the perfect mix of the types of movies I like. I like both, artistic and interesting films, but I also like some, dumb action movies like the Fast and Furious movies. And this kind of seems like a weird mishmash of those things from that's being mixed together into a franchise that I've liked for a long time.
Whereas Seth is on the,
he's indifferent.
Seth's lame.
Indifferent is probably the best word for it. Hesitant if we want to take it a little bit further, but it's probably closer to indifferent than it is to hesitant.
Which is
Seth.
A huge sin in the white noise department.
Hey, look, here's my meaning about Seth. I'm Seth. I like happy movies. I don't like dark movies. I think movies need happy moments to make joke around, so that way the totally dark stuff is
balance.
Bad.
I don't think they need happiness.
It doesn't need balance. It just needs to be a good movie. That's
yeah, no, and look, I might find a way. I might find some time to go ahead and sneak out to this one. But it's just the kind of thing that I saw in the trailer. Meh.
David, it has 99% Rotten Tomatoes now.
What? You're kidding, right?
99%.
See, it's like,
perfect.
That's objective.
73%.
All right, so who's the one rotten review? I need to find that just right now so I can, send them a bunch of hate mail on Twitter.
What if it was... If the review just says meh, we know it was Seth that wrote the review.
I plan on seeing the movie. I don't know if I will be able to see it because, Fandango's being weird and I'm not literally in Tuscaloosa and I want to use my gift cards. I'm probably going to see it Thursday at 7:10. Right. Why are they releasing the movie at 7:10? That's kind of weird,
I'm
going to see it.
I found it. David Edwards, who works for the Daily Mirror, a UK newspaper, says the movie is noisy, explosive, and visually spectacular, but depressingly hollow.
We've won wars against England before. We'll do it again.
The first line of the review is Tom Hardy has gone mad.
Has gone mad or bad?
Yes, he's gone mad. You know, it's like one of the, it's one of them pun things because the movie's called Mad Max.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I think he's like, oh, British star Tom Hardy, you know, he's too good for this kind of movie. He should be in Sherlock or The Imitation Game, like Benedict Cumberbatch, a great British star. That's what I imagine he thinks in his head.
Yes, yes, he should join the Weinstein Company to make an interesting commercialized critical bait film. Yes, smoking my pipe and writing my reviews. I'm going to go to a Broadway show.
Watch David Edwards be one of our 13 loyal downloaders.
We lost all of our fan. We just get a huge scathing smear review. He's like, I do not sound like that. I'm suing White Noise.
White Noise podcast is
the greatest
is
actor of all time.
My name's David, so I might as well be David Edwards.
More caviar.
Yes.
I find this film shallow and pedantic.
Like that meatloaf.
I dare say, Bigamond.
I imagine that Daniel Day-Lewis, he has like posters of him everywhere because he's a great British son, you know, and just he only watches BBC shows.
He's a great British son. Almost as good as the Great British Moon.
This, I don't know.
That sounds like a band name, Great British Son.
How do you think, like, okay, obviously, you know, James Bond stuff, like the coat or jacket that James Bond will wear in movies will be, like, the best-selling thing for some reason in certain areas, which is kind of crazy. How do you think, like, the average British critic feels about James Bond?
They think that us Americans have fucked with it, I think. That's probably my guess.
Okay, that's definitely one response, yeah.
I don't really know. I mean, I guess they would think that maybe it's kind of... I mean, I think most British fans, I think everybody really likes James Bond. I don't think that I don't think that people in Britain dislike James Bond. I mean, I think they still love it. Maybe some of the critics out there kind of frown on and say it's just like it's Hollywood has morphed this into something that has, you know, kind of gone beyond the original intent of the franchise. Well, but why the hell are we talking about James Bond right now?
But by the way, you know, real quick, before we get into it, we probably have the show and I'll let you talk about The Wire, but you know, John Oliver is not that popular in Britain. He's more popular in America than in Britain, which is probably the only British actor who's a lot more popular, or a comedian or anything, that's way more popular in America than Britain.
Probably because we've, like, claimed him.
I also
like, American News Parody has claimed him.
One of us.
Like,
one
he's now
us.
An American. He's the American's British guy. That's what we've claimed him as.
We are a melting pot. We need, like, American of everything, you know?
And we're just, like, trying to give them, you know, is Johnny Depp British? I forgot.
He's American.
Oh.
Who cares what he is nowadays?
He's a bad actor.
He could be whatever he wants to.
I mean, I don't know. He's a weird guy at this point. I don't know. I almost, like, don't want to see his movies at all anymore.
I wouldn't mind seeing him if it wasn't for the fact that everything he does now is a Tim Burton movie. I think he's in something lately... That isn't Tim Burton, but...
Anyways, we've been on here for too long. David, say your piece about The Wire, one of the greatest shows ever made.
The Wire. It good. I liked. I will continue watch.
All right, that
was
The
Wire.
That was it for White Noise Weekly, episode 7 this week. No, keep going.
No, but seriously, I mean, it has got a phenomenal cast. I mean, we talked about last night about how it just is probably the best... It's probably the best form of any media, in my opinion, that's done, you know, that's captured the actual... setting of a city. I mean, that's about as specific as we get.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I'm saying the setting of the city, not the setting in general. There's a difference. We'll argue about this another time.
I was going to say, this was Billy's assertion, but go on. Take credit.
Well, I mean...
Go ahead, David.
No. I mean, I agreed with you. I mean, I think I think it definitely does a great job with that. I think the cast is probably... in my opinion, the strongest part of the show. I mean, everybody down to, you know, the side character seems to put in a really great performance. And the fact that it's able to balance such an ambitious narrative is very admirable. The writing has to be very strong and concise and not waste any time with these characters in order to make them in order to make all these side characters important to the plot and also give them all their own unique personalities. I mean, it's just an incredible show, and I've enjoyed watching it.
What makes the show so great is not only is there such a diverse, insanely diverse set of cast members that are all incredible, but the fact that there really is no one character who is the most important part of the show or even close to, like, the most important part of the show. And, like season one, for example, is more about the drug trade, right? Season two goes big into the seaport system, I guess, you know, the shipping industry. So, season three is more about, you know, city bureaucracy and government. and a really fascinating subplot with the police station you'll hear. And 4, which is probably one of the most innovative seasons of all time, deals with the school systems, and it's probably one of the most fascinating pieces of television I've ever seen. Before ending with, sadly, the media was the last part, the print news media was his last target, which seemed to be him being pissed off by the media, so he decided to do that, and it just didn't work as well as the rest of seasons. But it's still very interesting because the city is a star, and a different aspect of the city is analyzed every season.
Well, it was fascinating to me is that the show is not like, it's not like one of those... It's not like a True Detective, which is going to have a new set of cast and characters each season and tackle a different story. What The Wire does is even more ambitious, in my opinion. It actually not only does that by adding a new layer, but it continues with the previous layers too, and it manages to still seamlessly follow those stories and add to them and continue to develop those stories while adding a completely new layer to the show. I mean, it's extremely ambitious what the show does.
And it's like characters like Bubbles, right? Watching the evolution of Bubbles over the course of 3 seasons, it's pretty fascinating. And the way, like, certain characters are integrated. And like I said, season 4 is so unlike the rest of the seasons. It's actually kind of an amazing accomplishment what they're able to do there, but I can't really talk about it now, obviously.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, don't spoil it.
I wish I could contribute. I've only seen the pilot.
Well, I mean, at a future date when the show takes off and becomes a hit success, we'll talk about our Wire thoughts after everybody finishes.
I'm going to try to you and me need to peer pressure Seth into watching The Wire instead of Sopranos. What a choice, though, between those two shows.
No,
we need to peer
pressure.
A lot of it's based right now on the fact that I've already seen about, episodes of Sopranos.
I've seen 3 episodes of Sopranos, and I stopped because my dad got mad at me for watching Sopranos as like a 13-year-old or whatever.
Seems like you're scarred for life. You can't watch The Sopranos. You get flashbacks from those terrible incidents.
It's the kind of thing that The Sopranos is just, one of my favorite shows right now that's still playing but won't be as of, 2 Sundays from now is Mad Men. Sopranos is more of a Mad Men type show in that it's very interior, tells a very, layered personal story, not necessarily, much bigger than that. And that's kind of for my impression of The Sopranos so far is that I like that, it delves into one person's psyche, one person's motivations, and to me, it's easier to keep track of that. The Wire is,
there's a lot of things going on at once. It's hard to keep up with.
I don't want to say exhausting, but
it is.
It's,
I would agree.
It really is exhausting. Yeah.
But yeah, we're going to watch it, but
we're kind of too far into this one, whatever. So I say let's just go, get out of here. We'll go back next week.
Wrap it
talk
up.
About Daredevil, assuming David actually finishes the season before
stuck the landing.
If I manage to watch about 10 minutes of each episode every day, I should be finished in time.
It reminds me of the Oscar podcast. Let's watch the Oscars. Okay, I'm going to rewatch all of Breaking Bad first.
I get sidetracked, man.
It's amazing you saw as many movies as you did. But anyways, I'm Billy White.
I'm David Hunter.
I'm Seth Judiak. I wasn't sure who was going first. I'm Seth Judiak.
See y'all next week, everyone.